Many provisions within Chapter 3, Strategic Direction, and Chapter 6, Landscapes, seek to protect natural features, such as outstanding natural landscapes, from all subdivision use and development. In my evidence, I detail several higher order documents that these provisions are not currently consistent with or giving effect to, including Section 6B of the RMA, which aims to protect these features and landscapes from inappropriate subdivision use and development, Policy H of the NPS, which states that planning and development of the national grid should seek to avoid adverse effects on outstanding natural landscapes and areas of high natural character, among other features, and Chapter B3 of the proposed RPS, which acknowledges that infrastructure may need to be located in particular areas and may have unavoidable adverse effects on nationally important values. The planner's report seems to acknowledge this inconsistency with the higher order documents, but considers that the inappropriate test is implicit. I disagree with the planner and consider that the provisions need to give effect to and be consistent with higher order documents, such as the RMA, NPS, and the proposed RPS. Otherwise, it will be confusing for future users of the plan, including decision makers. I also note that Dr. Mary Reid's evidence on landscapes refers to Section 6B of the RMA and the requirement to protect outstanding natural landscapes and features from inappropriate subdivision use and development. The planner's report also recommends a new policy, Policy 6.3.12, that seeks regionally significant infrastructure be located to avoid degradation of the landscape while acknowledging location constraints. The policy is currently worded does not recognise regionally significant infrastructure, which the planner's report acknowledges is the aim of the policy, but rather it recognises the locational constraints as an add-on. The policy does not give effect to the NPS, particularly policies 3 and 5, which together direct decision makers to enable the reasonable operational maintenance and upgrading of the national grid while considering the technical and operational constraints of the network. NSPAR's submission also sought to replace the word minimised with avoid, remedy or mitigate in several policies in order to ensure consistency with not only the RMA, the NPS and the proposed RPS, but also to respond to the recent King Salmon case. The planner's report states that the use of the word avoid in the policies effectively prohibits a particular type of adverse effect, and it may essentially place a ban on a certain activity. This further emphasises why the words need to be amended to avoid, remedy or mitigate, because as currently worded, national grid activities that could not avoid adverse effects may essentially be prohibited or banned. This could have detrimental effects on the growth of the district if the national grid cannot be efficiently and effectively operated, maintained, developed and upgraded. As a final matter, Transpower accepts the Council's planner's recommendation to accept and amend the new definition for regionally significant infrastructure, but does not support the amendment to refer to the national grid as electricity transmission infrastructure. The term national grid has been referred to throughout the proposed plan, including several definitions, such as national grid corridor, national grid subdivision yard, as well as the provisions contained within the utilities and energy chapter. The term the national grid is also consistent with the NPS and the NES. My evidence concludes that the proposed plan must give effect to the NPS and take into account the proposed Otago RPS, as well as being consistent with the RMA, and this is achieved through the amendments suggested in or supported by my evidence.
Just
look,
in regards to policy 3.5.2,
yes.
Transpower
put in a submission and provided evidence at the hearing to strengthen this policy to give more effect to the MPs. Yes, because as similar to our submission on the proposed plan, as it's currently worded, it says that infrastructure should avoid the location in areas of outstanding natural features and outstanding natural landscapes. And for the same reason, avoid from King Salmon means not allow. And as we already know, the National Grid currently transverses the outstanding natural landscape in the Gippsland Valley. And the Policy 8 of the MPs gives direction to seek to avoid rather than completely avoid
the steps. Yes, well, that was the nub of my question. Doesn't the effect of A, B, C in that
yes, B, C, and D do allow that. I agree.
Well, A does too, because it says avoid significant values.
Only significant values on vegetation and habitats.
And outstanding natural features. Avoid location and outstanding natural features.
Yes.
And then it says when it's not possible to avoid, avoid a significant adverse effect.
I consider that Policy 8 of the NPS, which says seek to avoid, recognises that Transpower's National Grid may not be able to avoid even significant adverse effects on those national features and landscapes, and that is why Policy 8 was drafted as it is. So Transpower may not be able to avoid significant adverse effects if a particular development, upgrade or use has location of technical or operational constraints which requires it to be located in that area. And they may seek to avoid them, but they may not always be able to achieve that. Yes, I think that policy is very similar worded to policy 3.5.2.
In terms of those changes to you're suggesting to put the term reaching significant infrastructure, what are the consequences for the remainder of the plan in terms of just try making this change and whatever else, because it only applying to reaching significant infrastructure, what else might that apply to in terms of what would it allow or enable that infrastructure to be able to locate, not just Transpower's, but any of the other ones on the list?
Do you mean the definition itself, or the amendment to point B?
The amendment.
To point B?
Yeah.
Changing to the national grid rather than electricity, just a transmission network?
Yep.
So the rest of the plan refers to the national grid, so all the rules and the objectives and policies in the utilities and energy chapter refer to the national grid. All the definitions refer to the national grid, and there's currently no other use of the term electricity transmission network. So I guess my concern is that you bring in a new term just for the regionally significant infrastructure definition, but it's not followed through to the rest of the plan. And I worry that that would create confusion to users of the plan as to why there's two terms for the same activity or asset.
Can I pick up on that? I suppose the proposition I put to you is that I don't think anyone could conceivably argue that the national grid is not electricity transmission infrastructure. The only confusion might be whether it extended more broadly and picked up the local line network. And given that you originally saw that it did include the local distribution network, I'm wondering what the problem is.
I guess the planner's report recommends not including the local electricity distribution network. The planner's report recommended deleting that point. And if that's how council wants to proceed, we would just want to make sure that it's very clear that the electricity transmission network does not also include the distribution network.
I suppose my question is, why? Why do you care?
Because there's always a lot of confusion between the distribution and transmission networks, which has created problems for Transpower and the distribution companies in the past. And if it's meant to include the distribution network, why not just say it in the definition?
Could Transpower lodge a submission on the use of that terminology in the proposed RPS?
Regionally significant infrastructure?
Yes.
Yes, we do. Yes, so policy 3.5.1 of the proposed RPS does refer to electricity transmission network, and Transpower submitted and gave evidence to change it to the national grid. Because as Mr. Renton alluded to, there are times when there's a line that comes from the generation, electricity generation, before it hooks into the national grid, which is also a transmission line. But it's not a line owned and operated by Transpower. So although it's not current in the Queensland Lakes, it can be in the Togo region, and that's why we submitted on the proposed RPS. So we would also like to keep it consistent with the proposed RPS, if that amendment is accepted.
Can I just get, you're not actually not wanting to protect distribution lines, you're just not particularly worried about protecting transmission lines?
Yes, correct. Yep.
So
we don't
want the specificity to ensure that rather than generality to ensure.
Yes,
that.
It's just as I mentioned, it's definition, it's terminology.
Yeah.
Anything can transmit electricity, just like water and pipe, but the national grid is this particular grouping of assets that transmits.
It's here.
Correct.
Okay.
No, not unless it's electricity generation facilities, because they have the EPS as well.
Yes, but that's not particularly relevant
to
what we're discussing.
Mm-hmm.
So the plan would give effect to the EPS without having the same provision made for all other regionally significant infrastructure.
Yes, as long as there are provisions, objectives and policies specifically for the national grid. And I guess we introduced the term regionally significant infrastructure so that there can be more general policies, as some councils don't like to have a lot of provisions specifically for the national grid.
Okay.
But as long as the national grid is provided for.
Is it our role to decide what's regionally significant, or is that better made at the regional level?
I think it is better made at the regional level, and that's why I would refer that to the proposed RPS as they have done this for the region. Although I do note that the planner's report and a recommended definition for regionally significant infrastructure, there is slight differences between the RPS and the district plan definition, because some of those regionally significant infrastructure are not located in this district. For example, ports and marinas.
Marinas are not actually in the proposed RPS, it's only ports.
Yeah.
And there's no railway lines of any national significance or regional significance.
I said
regional significance.
In paragraph 50 of your evidence, the last two sentences there, is that the provisions do not allow for appropriate subdivision use and development, such as electricity substations or lines, to be located within outstanding natural features. Do you expand on how those things are appropriate in an outstanding natural feature or landscape?
I guess I would go back to the NPS, and the policies clearly state that decision makers have to provide and enable the ongoing operation, maintenance, development and upgrade of the grid. And the NPS recognises that there may be unavoidable adverse effects, and the decision maker has to take into account the locational, technical and operational constraints. So there may be a situation where a national grid asset has to be located in an outstanding natural landscape or feature, and if that's the case, because national grid lines and substations are so highly visible, it would be very hard to avoid significant adverse effects on those features.
So, should we?
Can I just follow up on that? Proposition for you, Ms. Garvin, like, care to comment? I think we all know that King Salmon has shifted everyone's world view in the RMA field with its definition of what Section 6B's reference to appropriate means. Another aspect of King Salmon was that it said that one reason to refer back to Part 2 for an overall judgment is if a document does not give effect to Part 2. Question for you is that given King Salmon's clarification of Section 6B, is the NPSET consistent with Part 2 to the extent that it does not protect outstanding natural landscapes from significant adverse effects?
I still think the NPS is consistent with the decision. As there's still direction to seek to avoid those effects on those features, but it also recognises those constraints that transfer is subject to. Ms. Garvin,
if it's possible, I'd like to go to that question further thought and come back to you in a later hearing where I think this issue.
Yes, I accept that it's a massive curveball and that you might want to think about it.
Yes, I think the other thing you might like to come back with is from Ms. Claw's previous statement is whether what Transpower are really saying is that there may be truly exceptional circumstances where it's unavoidable to have those effects, and whether what has been sought actually doesn't reflect that circumstance, it reflects the circumstance of a somewhat lesser test. Mm-hmm. And I think that needs to be given some consideration.
Yes, sir.
In paragraph 64 of your evidence, down the bottom there, just regarding the not offering the options to avoid, remedy or mitigate effects, could you explain in the RMA where it talks about plans need provide for all three options?
I don't believe it does, but I know section 5 does talk about avoiding, remedy and mitigating adverse effects. Section 5 2c.
So should we rely on 5 2c for all of the provisions, or do we need to take account of the other parts in 6 where it talks about just the term avoid? As an example,
I think it needs to be applied on a case-by-case basis. But in terms of this particular policy, it's talking about adverse effects on minimising adverse effects on lakes, rivers, and wetlands. And minimising adverse effects may not always be possible, especially if there has to be an undergrounding of a line under a river or installation of a culvert. They may be minor adverse effects, and you may be able to remedy and mitigate them, but you may not always be able to minimise.
What does remedy and mitigate minimise the adverse effects? Because if you didn't remedy or mitigate, then you're not minimising.
Mitigating doesn't always mean that you're going to minimise the effects. It means you're just mitigating the potential effects.
Isn't the definition of mitigate to reduce the effect thereof?
I can't answer that though.
And another element, go back to Winstone's telling us that the general approach to the Winstone's decision of just Judge Whiting's court has always been, as far as I'm aware, the guide to avoid, remedy, mitigate said first avoid, then if you can't avoid, remedy, and then mitigate to the extent reasonable, reasonably possible. I think that was the words. It's not just like somewhere in the spectrum of doing a little mitigation or a lot. Again, it might be a legal issue.
In paragraph 73, you talk about the council's obligations to protect regionally significant infrastructure. Does that apply to all regionally significant infrastructure, or is it just the national grid?
In the context of the MPS, it would just be the national grid and its obligations to protect it.
So we don't have any requirement to do it for all regionally significant infrastructure?
Not that I'm aware of.
In terms of the policies that are in the MPS, which is the specific one that requires the council to do that? And to what level is that protection required?
Are there several policies in the MPS that direct that? So there's policy 10, which directs decision makers to avoid reversals to the effects on the national grid to ensure its ongoing operation, maintenance, development and upgrading.
Hmm. So is that a total obligation?
I think so, yes.
Doesn't it say to the extent reasonably possible?
Yes, which would be I think to the extent reasonably possible would be through objectives and policies to give direction to the decision makers that they have to, as far as they can, provide protection of the national grid. And ensure it's not compromised.
You were saying before that there were other policies as well.
Well, there's policy 11 as well, but that's more about including the transmission line on planning maps and consulting, local authorities consulting with Transpower. Mm. And I guess policy 1 is the overarching one, which states that they must recognise and provide for the national grid and its benefits and ensure it's secure, reliable supply in the future.
In paragraph 88, this is kind of related to my earlier question, but it's around this. You're talking there about providing an exemption for regionally significant infrastructure in regard to that
mm-hmm.
policy. So, I'm trying to understand if we did it for all regionally significant infrastructure, what's going to be the consequences of that in terms of what other activities are included in the definition of regionally significant infrastructure that might have effects through enabling things that don't have the backup of an NPS.
A lot of those regionally significant infrastructures have the same issue as Transpower in that it is highly, they are often highly visible. And the policy is currently worded says avoid adverse effects from development that may be highly visible. So telecommunication or radio communication masks will also be highly visible from public places, such as the national grid.
In terms of para 94, when you're talking about the objective, the way that's worded, what's the outcome sort there?
So it's to give effect to policy 3 of the NPS, which directs decision makers to consider the location of technical and operation constraints that the national grid has when it's developing, upgrading, maintaining and operating the line. And
so what's the outcome sort?
Environmental outcome.
Environmental outcome.
Not the legal outcome, the environmental outcome.
I guess when a resource consent is made for a development or a major upgrade, that this objective directs the decision maker when considering the extent of those adverse effects, particularly visual effects and significant visual effects, that they take into account the constraints that Transpower are under when they're planning and developing these assets.
If you were directing someone to do something, isn't that really a policy?
Yes, it could be a policy.
Well, that's a course
it.
Of action, isn't it,
mm-hmm.
that you're expecting?
Yep, I accept it could be a policy.
So it's not an objective.
in paragraph 96 on page 22. When you talk about the amendments will be limited as a case-by-case assessment of effects of the proposal is still enabled. So, is this in regard to the that for any applications that they, is this about the council assessing them on a case-by-case basis as they come in, or rather that, or rather something else, like should it be included in the plan? I'm just trying to understand where you're trying to go with it.
So what I was meaning that with the proposed objective and policy, it's directing council to consider the constraints that transfer under when thinking of the adverse effects. So it doesn't mean that the proposed objective and policy doesn't mean that the consents will always be granted. Rather, it's just directing the decision maker to consider these things at the consent stage. So it will still be assessed on a case-by-case basis, depending on the proposal and the adverse effects.
Thank you.
Two questions only. First, in relation to paragraph 89, my question to you is that your complaint is that there's only one policy which aims to promote the operation of districts and infrastructure. Is this a numbers game, or is it, would one policy be enough so long as it said the right things?
Yeah, if it covered all the aspects of the MPS, then I think we would be happy with one policy. But at the moment, it's only recognising the importance of infrastructure, regionally significant infrastructure, but there are many other components, such as managing adverse effects on that infrastructure, that also need to be recognised, and providing for the ongoing operation maintenance.
And the second question, building on the discussion and the evidence of the fire service, accepting that your focus has been broadening out from the national grid, is the provision of emergency services and part of regionally significant infrastructure to your mind?
Emergency services part of regionally significant infrastructure?
Correct.
To be honest, I think it's outside of my scope and I can't answer that. I haven't thought about it before, so.
Thank you.
Just one, in your preference for the word avoid for the mitigate versus minimise, then looking at your point 99, which refers to your comments in the original submission on 6.3.1.3, where you want to add the words at the bottom of your suggestion saying, or that there can be no feasible, practicable alternative route, and or that significant adverse effects can be outweighed by the overwhelming proposal. Where could the local community gain comfort that, in fact, the combination of all of that loosening of terms or broadening of ability for the Transparent Act would not just mean that the definition of feasible, practicable, would be swayed in the favour of easier to achieve rather than perhaps harder to achieve with less than a moment of impact?
I think it will still come down to the decision maker on a case by case basis. So there's still scope there.
There is still scope, but is there's different scope and surety, and maybe more scope is being given and less surety in terms of.
if you have a circumstance, as Commissioner Gilmore raised, shouldn't the policies be quite clear as to the circumstances when one drops into mitigation as opposed to avoiding, rather than that reading, leaving that rather loosely open? And I suspect that's what Commissioner Gilmore was getting at. Shouldn't the policy actually outline those circumstances of where we would get to that point, so that the decision maker actually has some guidance into how to apply it, rather than just on a case-by-case basis making an ad hoc decision depending on whether they're grumpy or not, perhaps. Not that commissioners at this table would be like that, but there is no telling.
I agree with your point, but I also think there's got to be a degree of flexibility for the developer or the infrastructure provider, and that doesn't, and that they can avoid, remedy or mitigate in that hierarchy.
But what I'm saying is, shouldn't the circumstances be specified at which point you choose one or other of those three, rather than just saying avoid, remedy or mitigate?
Because I just don't know how you would specify at what point they kick in.
Well, you earlier said, for instance, that they would be locationally constrained and there would be no practical alternative. Wouldn't that be one of those circumstances where you might drop from avoid to mitigate?
Yeah, if they were locationally, technically and or operationally constrained.
Yes, so those are the, couldn't the policy include that terminology to make that clear that those are the circumstances?
I'd have to have a think about it, to be honest.
Well, there are examples in other planes in the country, and I can tell you from experience that the first New Zealand Coastal Policy Statement on human effluent discharge to coastal marine waters said, avoid where practicable. But where avoidance is not feasible, then you can remedy or mitigate. So for at least 20 years, that has been within the terminology used in objectives and policies.
My only concern would be that policy 8 of the NPS is a seek to avoid,
yes,
which I think is a lesser degree than avoid where practicable.
The section 6A also says protect the natural character of the coastal environment, which means do not discharge human effluent into it, doesn't it?
Yes.
If you read it as the protect the natural character, but the NPS said there might be circumstances where you have to do that. So isn't that not a dissimilar circumstance?
I guess I would say that the NPS in Policy 8 isn't talking about the coastal environment, it's talking about...
We're not talking about the coastal environment, we're talking about a typically analogous situation where you have a high-level principle in the Act which has to be recognised and provided for in lower-order documents. And the lower order documents suggested the ways that you achieve that might include some circumstances where you can't totally protect. Isn't that the same circumstance that Policy 8 provides for? And the lower order documents can enunciate how the seeking to avoid would occur.
Yes, I'd just be worried about the seeking to avoid versus the avoid being practicable. I think there is a degree of difference there.
If you accept that you have more than just avoid,
mm-hmm.
then is it reasonable to set out what the circumstances might be where you slip away from avoid?
Yes, there may be.
concern you've been expressing about seeking to avoid is a lesser standard than avoid where practical. Have you got any case law that would provide us with guidance on that issue about the difference, if any?
I know that there's case law around what where practicable means. I'm not aware of it in that specific context, but we can definitely look into that and come back to you.
And the other question for Ms. Craw is, when you talk about the test, I think you said if it's not technically constrained as your test, is money a factor? Is it just I have been told that engineers could do anything if they have a sufficiently large budget.
Never say never.
Never say never. Put man on the moon.
So, and of course, practicability, in terms of cases with governments, incorporates cost as a factor. Is it just technical capability, or is it cost, or and a combination of the two?
It's technical and operationally. So I guess of course to come under operations.
All those types of situations that you're thinking of, for any situation as part of our requirements to the Electricity Authority, the Commerce Commission, the regulator, we have to develop a whole long list of options with all their pros, cons, that's the constructability, operability, impacts, and cost falls in there. And then we go through a consultation process to take that down to a short list where it's open for people to comment that a connected party or the end consumer may elect to choose an investment that is suboptimal economically, but it gives them whatever a better outcome is and it meets our technical requirements. So that's always a possibility, but it has to be done through a consultation type of process.
If your investment, i.e. you're upgrading the transmission corridor between here and Pomo, then that choice of suboptimal economically or not is yours rather than an external party. So where, and this comes back to my concern in terms of the 6313 of can we know feasible practical alternative three, and using avoid, remedy, mitigate versus minimise, at which point does the ONL, ONF character win over inappropriate or practical feasible?
We have to follow the same process all the way through, and it's open. We don't get to just decide. We put up any capital program has to be approved by the Commerce Commission. So we follow that process, so there is an open process of doing that, and we would make a recommendation as to why we've gone from a long listed item where it might have been in the list to not in the list to get to the short list, and then we have to repeat the process to get from the short list to the selected option, and we have to do that in a consultative way.
Is that with the Commerce Commission?
That's out to industry or stakeholders. So depending on the project,
is this helping us?
Depending on the project, that is.
So is the TA involved in the level of conversation, or does it not?
We do have them involved in the conversation for a large job, like the Bunnyfield Havens reconductoring project. We've been involved because of all the consenting issues to be able to get people approved to work sites, establish access roads, reinforced towers, et cetera, et cetera. They were involved in that before the project became the approved project, because we needed to know that it could be done safely in the community, understood where and why and what the options were.
Okay.
So, yes.
One last one. In relation to the Commerce Commission's oversight of transparent investments, does the Commerce Commission have any environmental mandate?
Not as far as I'm aware, they're worried about the dollars.
I suspect it's a trade-off.
But it is the customers who make that trade-off and the customers in this case are people like you who live in the area. So you get to inform your stakeholders as to what you can afford your money to be spent.
That's an economic.
From the Commerce Commission, they do have it is an economic stack and rank, but you can have a suboptimal economic investment if you value other items. Because we're slightly agnostic, our goal is to deliver the best technical solution that minimises all the impacts and maximises the value through the life of the asset. But you can have whatever you want if you're prepared to pay for it.
That suggests to me that the district plan can include some forms of limitation, because that's part of the trade-off that you're talking about, because that's the community's expression.
Provided you are fully aware, I guess, of the impact of your decision. For example, if you wanted to underground the lines into Frankton, there may be resilience issues that we'd have a bit of a worry about during this phase. Point one, and we'll continue down.
I'm just saying that in terms of this high level stuff that we're dealing with here, we're not dealing with that and the evidence we have before us, as to the likely realistic things that are likely to happen within 10 years, then I think it clearly can be in terms of the district plan can set some parameters as to what it seeks, how it seeks TransPower to give effect to Policy 8. And I think that is really where that question is related. And given there are no more questions, I'm sure there are no more, Ms. Gavin, I think the sensible thing to do would be for you and this call to take note of the questions and look at some of those reliefs that could be adjusted and provide those material we wanted, and I think if that could be provided by the beginning of next week, that would be appropriate.
Thank you, sir, and thank you for your time today, and I apologise that we've underestimated the time, and in the future we'll ensure we make greater allowances.
Yes. Thank you. Significantly over time. We will go through, I haven't discussed this with my fellow commissioners, but I'll tell them, we will go through to 1:30 in an attempt to try and catch up some of that time. And at the end of the day, we actually have another hour and a half, so we can keep up our sleeves. But we will probably finish by 5 at the end of the day. It just means a little bit of delay as to when you will start. But now we have Royal Forest and Bird Protection Society.
Good afternoon, Commissioner. Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Thanks. today I'm Susan Elizabeth Mitcher, and I haven't appeared before you before, and I don't know many of you, so I'm the Regional Manager Conservation for Otago Southlands for Forest and Bird, and I work for our national office, so for the whole of our organisation. So this submission is on behalf of our whole national organisation. We do have a branch in Central Otago Lakes, and so these are incorporated in the submissions. So what I've done today, and I apologise for not getting this to you at the end of the month, it is only just a few notes in talking to the submissions that we have made. So I hope you'll forgive me for not sending it in advance. For those of you who don't know Forest and Bird, we are a national organisation and we have more than 70,000 members and supporters, and that's in 56 branches rurally throughout New Zealand, including Central Otago Lakes. So what I just plan to do today is to really just quickly comment on some of the responses in the Section 42A report by the planner, which I shall refer to as that report, because I think our submission pretty much speaks for itself. And in relation to the strategic direction chapter, we were largely quite happy with the direction that that chapter was taking, because we do agree that it needs to provide a strong and unambiguous policy framework in dealing with the district's significant issues, and of course the natural environment is one of the significant issues for the district. So just in terms of goal one, Forest and Bird made a submission on this point, and we support the report's idea to take out appropriately considered, because of the problems with the definition of appropriate and what that means. So going back to avoided ground level mitigated makes sense to us. In terms of looking at the objectives 3.2.4.1 under goal 4, we supported goal 4, and but we noted that one thing that was missing from the policies was recognition to the council's duty to maintain biodiversity. And we see that the planner has reported that has agreed with us and agreed that that should be put into objective 3.2.4.1. So we support the recommendation. Just in case there's some confusion, the italics under the objective is the original objective, not what the report has recommended. I just put that in there so that you didn't have to keep flipping backwards and forwards to the original plan, proposed plan. Looking at policy 3.2.4.1, this is the policy that deals with areas of significant Indigenous vegetation and the mapping of those habitats. And our submission sought to amend that policy so that it sets out more clearly the strategic direction that the Council intends to take in terms of the management of significant Indigenous vegetation, in terms of how it be mapped, how they will go about the ongoing identification of significant inherent areas, because it's inevitable in any survey that areas will be must off that list. And also ideas and understandings of what are significant changes, and of course the definitions of when species are threatened, that changes over time as well. So it's really difficult to have an up-to-date schedule of significant natural areas, and there needs to be an ongoing process for that identification and protection. And while we agree that that is dealt with, as the planner points out, in Chapter 33 and Policy 33.2.1, but we also agree that repetition can, however, serve a reinforcing purpose. And given the state of significant Indigenous biodiversity in Queenstown Lakes District, we think that this does need reinforcing. So the plain reading of the objective and policy is that it only applies to the protection of areas that have already been identified, because they are defined as those that are referred to as the significant natural areas on the district plan maps. And so that, in our view, may give plan readers the impression that if an area is not identified on a planning map, then it won't be significant. And that's something that wouldn't be very good to foreshadow or suggest resubmit in the council's chapter 3, which is the overall strategic framework. And it's really in conflict with the policy 33.2.1, because that specifies that there is going to be ongoing identification of SMAs through resource applications. So Forest and Bird is concerned that Indigenous vegetation continues to be cleared, and some of that is significant and would have qualified as significant. And as I said, given the significance of much of what remains in the lowlands, and that's where development pressure is greatest, the identification and protection of SMAs is a nationally important matter. Forest and Bird considers it important that the chapter setting the strategic direction be very clear that there will be ongoing identification and protection of SMAs. And I've suggested a more elegant way of incorporating that than we had in our submission, which is to ensure the protection and ongoing identification of areas of significant Indigenous vegetation and significant habitats of Indigenous fauna through scheduling them in the district plan and through resource consents. And as I'm not a, I'm a resource management planner, but not necessarily a, don't write plans, I'm sure somebody can come up with more eloquent reading than I have come up through. Looking at policy 3.2.4.2, again, we agree. This was the policy that really sort of sets the tone for the biodiversity offsetting, and the planner's report recommends that it's too fine-grained, doesn't really belong in the strategic directions chapter, and Forest and Bird agrees with that, and we will deal with that when we come to the chapter on biodiversity. The objective 3.2.4.4, this is the one dealing with all those trees that I can see out the window, with the exotic vegetation with the potential to spread and naturalise. And so the report recommends amending this objective to give better focus on the environmental outcome. And in the discussion, that's said to include landscape and nature conservation values. And the report, in its analysis of the objective, notes that wilding species are also a threat to landscape habitats as well as the well-being of communities. And it challenges a number of matters in sections 6 and 7 of the RMA. However, the recommended wording in Section 42 report is avoid the spread of wilding exotic vegetation to protect nature conservation values. And that's where we think there's a problem, because it narrows that down to the outcome is only about protecting nature conservation values. And so that objective would then not apply to avoiding the spread of wilding exotic vegetation for other purposes, such as landscape. And as the New Zealand Wild and Conifer Management Strategy states, in the wrong place, wild and conifers compete with native vegetation, change existing ecosystems, reduce available grazing land, limit future land use options, visually change landscapes, can affect surface flows and aquifer recharge and water sensitive catchments, and can result in damaging wildfires. So there's a whole host of reasons why you want to avoid the spread of wild and exotic vegetation. So to narrow it down, we think will cause problems. We agree that the outcome sought is to avoid the spread of wild and exotic vegetation. And as I said, the narrowing down is narrow and may have unintended consequences. And it also conflicts with the purpose and the objectives that are set in Chapter 34. However, I would like to congratulate Council, because we agree that the spread of wild and exotic vegetation is significant, and it's thus appropriate that it is elevated and considered in the chapter on strategic directions. And so we congratulate Council on giving prominence to the issue of wildings in the proposed plan. So, of course, naturally, we agree with Policy 3.2.4.1 that the planning of exotic planting of exotic vegetation with the potential to spread is prohibited, and we agree with the planner's report there. However, it does rely on correctly identifying the species, and Forest and Bird has recommended in our submissions relating to chapter to Rule 34 that there are some other species that the Council may consider be added but we will deal with those in later submissions. And just to finish, this was one of our further submission points. We opposed PowerNet's submission, which was seeking into this chapter a new goal with objective and suite of policies regarding the provision for the ongoing operation and growth of regionally significant infrastructure. And we considered that the policies and the objective was too detailed and doesn't belong in that chapter. And so that, because the strategic direction focuses really on the district's special qualities. So we thought that it's better dealt with in chapters 27 and chapter 30. So thank you for the opportunity to appear before you.
Just a couple of questions, thinking. Just where you're referring to the council's responsibility in terms of maintaining Indigenous biodiversity, are you aware of, is there anything in the Octave RPS or the proposed RPS that indicates which councils are responsible for which or in a direct?
Yes, but I didn't read it yesterday, so it slipped my mind the details. I know there is discussion about who has responsibility for it, and we have tried to suggest that the regional council should be the one that coordinates the identification and make sure that every district is following similar criteria and has a similar process, so that you don't have landowners on who have properties that cross the boundaries having to deal with different criteria or different processes for dealing with SNAs, and that there needs to be a regional consistency, and we suggested that the regional council should be the leader for that.
Did they not like that idea. Did you put in submissions to the proposed RPS regarding those matters?
We did. Yeah.
And then my other question was just in regard to the policy 32441, and as I understand, this is about the planting of exotic vegetation, and it's got avoid the potential to spread and naturalise. Does that cover? That covers plantings only new. Should the policy be around something to do with the existing ones as well?
I can't remember what's in. Yes, it should be. And is that dealt with? Can't remember what's in chapter. I've got a full submission here. But I think that's why the planner recommended. Yeah, because it's not. It's not. The objective is to avoid the spread. And the policy is the planting. But I'm not sure off the top of my head what is in the detailed chapter, but yes, you're quite right. It's not just the new ones, it's the old ones that are causing a problem.
No. That's fine, thank you.
It's an interesting point, so I'm not sure how you have a rule that deals with the ones that have already gone, that are on other properties, not necessarily from the one that would have the resource consent in the past, or may not have needed a resource consent.
That's fine, thank you.
Two questions only. Can you help me please, paragraph 8, refer to the council's duty to maintain Indigenous biodiversity. Can you tell me where the council's duty is specified in that regard?
It's either section 31 or 32.
So it's in the council's function.
RMA, yeah.
And the other point is that you're supporting the recommendation of staff delete policy referring to environmental compensation. I can understand that as soon as you dip your toe in that particular pond, there are various issues from different parts of the spectrum. accepting that the detail will all be in as a chapter 33, do you think there's some merit in referring in a general way to environmental compensation as more particularly defined and meets and bounds set out in that later chapter, given the role of the strategic chapters to provide, as someone else has put it, a hook for later, more detailed provisions?
Environmental compensation and biodiversity offsets and the differences between those terms is problematic. And just bear with me a minute, I'll just go to what was originally proposed. 3.3.4.2.1.
Yes, I can understand why you might have had a problem with what was originally proposed. But if you could just think about the concept.
We're not very enamoured with, biodiversity offsets, if they follow the principles, and even then, Forest and Bird has difficulty with biodiversity offsets because there's a lot of research that says that conditions are not adequately enforced in resource consents, and that's a problem with biodiversity offsets as well. And the sense that when you're dealing with significant natural areas, then the idea is that you're really trying to protect them, and so that should be the emphasis that's in the strategic direction. The idea of having biodiversity offsets is really if there's something that would be nationally significant that would warrant destroying something that was nationally significant in terms of the indigenous vegetation. And in that case, you may look at biodiversity offsets. But there's such that definition of the mitigation, the hierarchy, and all the conditions that require to the consideration of offsets. The wording in that policy, we have to be very careful.
Thank you for that.
Just a clarification, just want to confirm on 3.2.4.4, what you had in your table in the outcome fire, that still remains that avoid planting exotic vegetation with the potential to spread and naturalise. That's what you want, that's your suggested rewording? That still extend?
For the planting?
3.2.4.4 objective. I presume that's if you haven't mentioned anything else.
Sorry, can you just
put
which?
In the table of your original submission, you had alternate wording for that objective. I just wanted to confirm that's what you're still supporting.
you caught me out, didn't you? Yes, because I can see your point that there is an issue. Because we said that we weren't sure what avoid exotic vegetation with the potential to spread and naturalise. We weren't certain what the activity was, which is why we suggested planting in our submission. That's why we suggested planting there, but there is a problem in that. What do you do about the ones that are already there?
Thank you. In your 3.2.4.2.1, 0.13 on your submission. So you're saying through resource consents, are you suggesting that any resource consent covered by this should be having a section on whether it includes indigenous vegetation or anything?
Yes, and we deal with that in our submissions to the chapter on biodiversity.
Okay. So you're in there. Thank you. And in terms of the one about wild, it was agreed that the conservation values are too narrow. If it were widened to include things like landscape, agriculture, economic, and tourism values, would that meet the your concerns?
It may do, but I'm not sure why you need to qualify.
So the you just prefer not to qualify?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Because it's not, the other policies don't qualify the reasons why you don't. Okay. So consistency doesn't require you to do that.
Yes, thank you, Ms. Marlon. All my questions were answered, I would say.
Thank you.
Does Ms. Lemaire seek a here? Yes, please, I'll come forward.
Thank you for the opportunity to present our submission and to talk to it. My name is Kerry Lemaire-Seek and I'm here today on behalf of my husband Roland to object to all the changes put forward by the submitters on Queenstown Lakes proposed district plan 2015 stage 1. The submitters GW Stalker Family Trust, Mike Henry, Mark Tilden, Wayne French, Dave Finland and Sam Strain. My husband, Roland, and I own and operate Ladies Mole Pet Lodge, Queenstown's only pet warming facility. We're located at 465 Ladies Mole, State Highway 6, opposite Howard's Drive leading into Lake Hayes, and I've included a map showing the reference. We provide a very valuable service to the Wakatip area. We care for people's pets. Set up over 40 years ago by Alan and Elizabeth Hunter, and operated in conjunction with Alan's vet practice and Elizabeth's pet grooming business. We're very passionate about the service we provide, and the quality of care for each pet is our priority. Whether the pets are young, healthy, elderly, or if they have personal medical conditions that require extra care. 15 years ago, we were fortunate to buy the business and property, and at the time the business and property were put up for sale, there was considerable concern from the community and the only other vet, Colin Wakeland, that the pet lodge would not be sold for a different purpose and there would be nowhere for people to board their pets or sold for a different purpose. So, 15 years on and we're yet again faced with an uncertain future for our one and only pet lodge if the submitters are granted the changes they seek. I think it's very important for the panel to have an understanding of the service we provide for the community, so I'd like to give a brief outline of what we do. Our clients' reasons for pet care are varied. It could be that they're going away on holiday, going outside Queenstown for work, medical or health issues, a bereavement in family, they could be renovating a house or building a house. They might be unable to find accommodation that allows them to keep their pet. They could be rehoming a pet or transferring outside of Queenstown. The pet could be placed in our care to protect them from the trauma of fireworks or an abusive neighbour. The stay period of a pet can be as short as one day or as long as a year. The pet's character determines the care needs for their stay. Each one is different, just like people. Their personality determined by their breed, the family they come from, if they've been trained, introduced to different situations to gain confidence, been boarded at an early age, really separated from their owners, or if they've had previous abusive owners and have been rehomed. One of our requirements to board is that all new clients must complete a visit with us. This gives us the opportunity to find out the individual needs of each pet, including vaccination cover, health issues,
feeding requirements. It also allows us to explain how and where we care for the pets and go over our policies and procedures for boarding. For our cat owners, we don't require to let their cat, but all dog owners will be required to bring their dog to a visit so we can assess the character needs for boarding. It's about being able to provide the care needs for each individual pet and start the process for the new owner to have confidence in what we do. We take very seriously the close relationship that owners have with their pets. For a lot of our clients, their pets are their children, or the last link with their husband or wife have passed away. And for Roland and I, the responsibility of care we provide must reflect that. At this point, I'd like to focus on the dogs, as they are the ones that will be most affected by the proposed changes sought by the submitters. Most dogs arrive with great excitement. Their previous boarding experiences have been positive, and they have good memories of their stay with us. And for most of them, it's not unusual to have the same playmates back at the same time. We encourage the dogs to socialise, and this will be determined by the personalities we have at the time. Mixing dogs is not something that everyone can do. First and foremost, you have to be the top dog, and this will set the behaviour of the dog's supervised playtime. Playtime is full of noise. We have four areas where our dogs can socialise and play. Our dogs require as much playtime outside as we can provide to get them exhausted by the end of the day, so that they will settle at night. The amount of exercise will be determined by the weather conditions, the number of dogs boarding, and the personalities of the dogs. Our boarding dogs treat our facility as their home. They are protective and will bark and alert immediately if they see or hear something that is not normal for lodge life. We know from their bark if a stranger has arrived on site, or if our cat has wandered across the paddock, or if a bird has tried to steal their food. And without going to the lodge, we know which bark belongs to which dog. That's the close relationship we have with our dogs. For our family and tenants living on site, our activities revolve around the boarding dogs. We never have large gatherings, no screaming children, loud music, fireworks, or anything that will trigger our dogs to bark unnecessarily. When noisy activities occur outside our property, not only do our dogs get disturbed, but also we do. It could be also from helicopters flying low, small planes and balloons flying overhead, fireworks, loud music from adjoining neighbours blasting till the early hours of the morning, which happened recently. It doesn't happen that often, but when it does, it makes for a very wakeful night if the dogs start barking. Fretful dogs, and yes, there are a few that stay with us. These are the dogs that have huge anxiety problems due to how they feel about being separated from their owners. No amount of enticement to socialise or be comforted can unfocus them from their feeling of abandonment. They will sit, howl, whine, and bark. They are dogs whose owners work from home, dogs that are really separated from their owners. There is little that can be done to take away their anxiety. And for those of you who are dog owners, you may be able to relate to the dog behaviour I've just described. It's unrealistic to expect our boarding dogs to be silenced when required. We are concerned that even though we have a historical right to operate our pet lodge, those who choose to live on Ladies' Mile still have the ability to complain about noise under Section 16 of the Act, and we have to comply. Dogs barking, stags roaring, sheep and cow noises are all part of our rural character.